Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Sales is King. Dan Sixsmith, glad you are with us and super excited to have Michelle Killebrew returning to the podcast. Michelle, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Dan, it's great to be with you today. It's been a couple of years.
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. It's been a minute, but glad to have you back. Love to catch up with you and tell me what you've been up to. I know you've had a couple of very interesting roles since we connected last. Tell us about it a little bit.
Absolutely. So you and I had a very interesting conversation when I was in sort of startup land. But I think the majority of our conversation actually had to do with B2B sales and a lot of my IBM experience. After that, I rejoined some of my former IBM colleagues at CA Technologies that was going through a digital transformation in its own right, but quickly thereafter was acquired by Broadcom, which a lot in the tech world, just in terms of that rate and pace of change, really.
They're taking over the world in tech.
Right.
VMware now, right? And yes. What's next, man? Big.
Yes, indeed. And so did some really exciting work in my short stint there, but had the opportunity to kind of bring it together at PwC in terms of the startup world and enterprise world and technology. So I joined their new ventures division. They had been incubating 10 different SaaS products, not investing, but building within their old four walls. And they were really trying to think through new business models and how they might continue to evolve themselves. And so I had the privilege of joining pre-revenue and standing up the go-to-market engine of these 10 different SaaS solutions. We had everything from cybersecurity being sold into Fortune 200s all the way down to super high-velocity SaaS solutions that were being sold into solo practitioner law firms and some mid-market enterprise in the middle. So the opportunity to build up a platform, if you will, across 10 of these different ventures. We launched 7. I did everything from the trademarking, website build, and feel, and the team to support that. And just so much fun. Again, bringing that startup experience within a professional services company who is not familiar generally with software go-to-market, number one. And number two is SEC regulated. So a really juicy challenge in all of that. And then during COVID, of course, as many companies did, we pivoted and actually brought together multiple of their different innovation teams together under the new brand new business unit called Products and Technology. And this was essentially enterprise software for PwC. And so I had the privilege to build that entire organization sort of on some of the foundation which we had built in New Ventures, although some of the value proposition was quite different. More enterprise software, different makeups, team dynamics. And so, you know, everything from building out new job families to attracting a different type of talent to support enterprise software. Of course, very close collaboration with the sales organization, which was being built up in lockstep with my sales counterpart, with whom I had a phenomenal relationship. And, you know, once I'd kind of gotten everything in place there, had the wonderful opportunity to come back and work with Matt Pressure at NTT, who's going through a massive transformation in its own right. NTT Limited was actually formed in 2019, right before the pandemic, through the consolidation of 32 acquisitions that NTT Holdings had made over the course of 20 years. And so, you know, massive, rapid change as they brought those companies and those value propositions to market.
Wow. Incredible. Yeah. So on PwC, what sort of team were you able to pull together for this undertaking? How many people and how did that process go? Awesome. Wow, yeah. Those are two really juicy opportunities. And really interesting. So let's, you know, we've got a lot to talk about today. Let's get into a few different topics in terms of, you know, B2B. Let's talk about the role of the CMO a little bit. How have you seen that evolving over the last couple of few years in the kind of post-pandemic world?
Oh my gosh. Well, the role of CMO is ever evolving and it seems to not slow down. I was listening to an AI for Marketing Leaders webinar just last week, and it was phenomenal. It was also just kind of jaw-dropping in terms of the rate and pace of change, both on what is technically capable and then how people are starting to think about the team dynamic with which to put that through their organizations beyond sort of the experimentation on the edges into how do you operationalize it. But I think one of the things for marketers or chief marketing officers, which was very interesting to me, is that part of their job, especially in say the mid to smaller organizations, and then you might have say a dedicated leader in larger organizations, but the CMO will still have to have some real fundamental knowledge, is almost this chief AI officer kind of role of how to deploy that technology, both again in the work as well as from a team construct. So I think that's the latest evolution. But going back to your original question, since the pandemic, it's just been consistent, continued evolution for what the CMO is responsible for. And I don't necessarily think that it's fully understood the proliferation of how many different functional specialties, the depth of knowledge within technology that's really required to lead the role successfully. But yes, I think that one of the things since the pandemic that has become even more so, this was already a problem. It's not really a problem. It's already, I'll say, a challenge that was on most CMOs' desks, is really just measuring and proving performance and just focusing on execution and ROI to an nth degree. And I think we're seeing some of that in the market. Obviously, there are macroeconomic headwinds as companies kind of pull back some of their expenditures, especially in the technology space, where they kind of pulled a lot of that forward to meet the dynamic demands of remote working. And now they're trying to consume a lot of that technology that they have purchased. And they're trying to rationalize, do we really need this entire SaaS platform for this one feature? And so there's a lot of tech rationalization that's happening that's kind of causing a pullback in the market. And when you think about that, one of the things that that's been top of mind for me is how many companies are revisiting their market strategy, not marketing, but market. Is their offering still fit for purpose? Do they know their ideal client profile? Has that ideal client profile shifted? Are their customer needs different? Should they be looking at going into adjacent markets? Should they be looking at different acquisition strategies? And I think that with this push to remote work, it's easy to go and focus on execution in a remote environment. I think that's part is easy, but actually coming together and thinking through strategically corporate strategy, market strategy seems to have not been revisited with as much significance as maybe it ought to. And the marketing team is then feeling that because they're under the pressure of more and more of that execution, without the time to actually say, wait a second, are we aiming in the right direction? Do we have the right message for the right people in market versus let's just put more paid, let's put more demand in market for something that might be slightly calibrated off? So those are some of the things that I'm thinking through just in terms of, yes, there is pressure to perform and it's significant. May want to just take a pause and make sure that you're aiming in the right direction.
Yeah, it's such a good point on market. I was just speaking to a CRO yesterday, and they for a tech company, and they had switched, you know, their ICP, and they moved more larger company focus. And, you know, there's a little bit of pain and suffering around that because the, you know, the cycle time suddenly got longer.
Yeah.
You know, but, and last year was kind of a painful year for them, but they're coming through now, and I'm happy that they did that. But, you know, it's one of these things, one of my connections talks about, you know, working in the business versus working on the business. And it's like, you know, it like the day-to-day insanity where you're running and putting out fires and trying to do all this stuff. And do we take that step back and really, really understand, you know, is this the right market? You know, is this the right ICP? So I love that. I wanted to get your take on kind of, you know, focusing marketing on acquisition versus kind of, you know, current customer base. There is, it seems like there's so much resources on new logos, and we're always, you know, demand gen and all this stuff. But is there enough focus on the current base and kind of mining customer success? Someone I recently spoke to said customer success is the new demand gen. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's a great, great question. In fact, I reorganized my marketing team at the beginning of this fiscal year, and we hadn't spoken about this. And I was also recently on sort of a CXO debate around who owns expansion revenue, and that was a lot of fun too. So I think both of those are critical. It's a phenomenal question. So first of all, beginning of this year, I reorganized my team into sort of three main pillars. Now I lead a regional marketing team. I am chief marketing officer for the Americas. That's North America and Latin America. And so what I did was I had an acquisition team focused on new logos and marketing source. I had a client marketing team. And this was most predominantly, we've expanded more into account-based management in coordination with sales. But that's also evangelism and case studies and voice of the client and all of those things. So client marketing specifically, and then partners and channels, right? So you've got sort of three main pillars in region there. And I did that intentionally because the motion for acquisition and the motion for expansion are completely different. And the way that you invest is completely different. So your acquisition engine is going to have more of your budget actually in the media, in the acquisition. So, you know, it's the client acquisition cost. On your client marketing, it's people-based. You need people to be able to understand what's happening within that client, to sit down and do the account planning with the sales organization. Where does the sales team need support? How can marketing help create new relationships within that organization? Where is that opportunity to play? And that is labor intensive. I think that there's a huge opportunity to bring some of that back with the application of AI, but it is bespoke, right? And so that's. And then of course channels are so important, and I think. I was just reading another post on LinkedIn the other day about sort of the pitfalls of partner-led growth. It sounds wonderful on paper, and I think that we should all be doing it, but I don't think we have figured it out efficiently yet as an industry, just in terms of how to stand up the most effective channel relationships. Yes. So absolutely. Acquisition and expansion and customer success is huge. I think a lot of companies, again, the conversations that I'm having and what I'm reading, they are so focused on getting the sale that they forget that most of the revenue is going to come from an existing client. It's going to come downstream, which is going to be based on that initial interaction pass off from sales into the success organization. It has to do with customer success and you know, just customer experience overall. And that customer success creates champions within the organization, which leads to increased revenue. And I think that's an area where companies are struggling. I think because of the macroeconomic headwinds and because everybody's fighting for each sale to come across the line, and the deal cycles are expanding, and the number of stakeholders that are in the consideration set, the buying committees are increasing. So the sales process is becoming more complex and longer. And so companies kind of thinking about how they need that revenue are focusing on that moment in time, and with constrained resources are putting them on the front end. And I agree with you. I think there is risk at not building out more effective customer success teams to retain and grow those clients that are being won.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so tricky. And you know, like you said, the headwinds, and you've got a lot of choices, right? And CFO pressures, tech stack consolidation. So you've really got to, you know, sometimes struggle to even hold the business, you know, let alone expand it. But there is a lot of great opportunity there. I wanted to get your take on, you know, on the acquisition front, and just on B2B marketing. You know, there just seems like there's a lot of noise, a lot of clutter. How are you seeing, what are some of the successful approaches, you know, to breaking through? I read something recently where they said, you know, the B2B buyer is now demanding, you know, B2C like experiences and personalization, and they're just inundated, right? I mean, you look at your inbox and it's just like, you just can't wait to delete some of this stuff. What's working?
Gosh, I think we need to test and iterate more. I think we know what clients want, but here's what I worry about a little bit, especially as teams are starting to dabble in AI, and they're dabbling in AI from a content creation, that rather than thinking through different ways of engaging, they're creating more of the same. Right. So, you know, that email that you got that you're trying to unpack, you're going to get 10 more of them because they can, you know, leverage AI to create content that maybe
even more bad emails.
Slightly scaled to your preference. I think I think it comes to stepping back and thinking strategically. Teams have been doing a lot of the same things for a while, and I think that people have gotten into their swim lanes. You know, I was talking to a colleague the other day, and we were having this conversation of, even when their teams are going into the office, they're taking their meetings from Zoom. So they're not even coming together and meeting to ideate. And so, you know, if you're an email marketer with a job, and your job is to create email marketing, and you're not coming together as a marketing team to think through how might we approach this problem, and you're going to do more of the same, more of the same isn't going to yield very much. One of the things, so you may recall that I worked for in the MarTech space. So further back in my career, I was a demand marketer for a web analytics company that was later acquired by IBM. And one of the things that became challenging, I had the product team down the hall, and I was, you know, really having fun kind of experimenting with our own technology and seeing what worked, and was able to do that to some degree. But when we started kind of pushing the envelope and programmatic media buying, we didn't have enough data within the B2B environment to actually deliver those B2C experiences. They're operating on millions of data points. Whereas in a B2B environment, you just don't have that volume of data. And that's going to be interesting when we come back to the AI conversation as we continue to evolve there. But there's only so much that you could do to personalize. But I think it is about cutting through the clutter. I think we can be more creative by understanding personas more effectively, and understanding how to create some levity in the messaging that gives you a chuckle in the middle of your workday instead of a groan and a delete. And thinking through who our core audience is. Sometimes it's it's just stopping and thinking. I was coaching an email marketer. I won't say when, I won't say what company, but they had this very cute subject line. And I said, you realize that you're trying to reach a CIO. This cute subject line is not going to fly. It reads like a marketing email, and it reads like a marketing email that doesn't understand who I am or what my problems are. So I think it's about empathy. I think it's about some levity to break up, you know, the chaos of the day, and then trying to determine what is valuable. Another stat that I saw recently was just, and I don't think this is a surprise. I think we knew that it was coming, but it was a good reminder for me just the way that the headline was written. I don't remember the statistic, but the net of it was short video works. People are busy. Right. So give me some news I can use in a soundbite. Give me something that gives me the headlines and makes me want to engage further. The 10 plus page white paper may not be the best way to convey the information. And so I think we need to, you know, again, back to that empathy. People are time starved. So think about how you consume media and what's going to get you to stop in the moment.
I mean, I think of listening to you, it's like the word that came to mind to me was authenticity. Yes. If you could somehow convey that, you know, and stand out and differentiate in some way, you know, that's definitely going to help. So we talked a little bit, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, kind of the virtual and the back to the office. What's your opinion? You know, it seems to be the trend is kind of hybrid, leaning toward coming back. Obviously, my son's in the finance world, and you know, all those major companies, they've been back for, you know, for a couple of years now. They were just mandated to come back in, the New York, you know, finance companies. But where do you see it going, and where should it be, you know, in your opinion?
Sure. Well, I had been managing globally remote teams since 2010. So this was not a big shift for me personally. Mm-hmm. And I think it depends on the organization. I really do. And the culture that they set up, although I think it has to be intentional. It doesn't make sense to force people to come to the office if they're going to sit in cubes. It just doesn't. You're, you know, creating a community that is creates friction on the employee side and doesn't really create any goodwill or, you know, benefit on the employer side. That said, I think you need to be intentional. And even if you have remote teams, you have to make it a priority to come together. You just have to. It's the personal relationships that make the remote working that much more impactful, because you know your colleague has, you know, their kids growing off to school, or this one's in kindergarten, or this one is taking care of, you know, their parents, or you just create a different sense of teaming and compassion for one another by creating those intentional gatherings. And for some companies, so what I did in New Ventures at PwC, everybody was in the Bay Area, but pre-pandemic traffic in San Francisco Bay Area was not pleasant, right? So you're coming from the entire corners of the Bay, myself included, and trains or commutes or ferries or whatever it might be. And because, as I mentioned, we're working on different, the teams were working on different ventures, they weren't necessarily working always as a marketing team. Their venture team, their product team, their sales team is going to be remote and elsewhere. So I set up what I call Team Tuesdays. And Team Tuesday was the day that we all came into the office to come together as a marketing team to go through priorities and to ideate. That was our whiteboarding day. That was our coming together as a team day. And then, so it wasn't, you know, some parts of the team are coming in Tuesday, and other parts are coming in Wednesday, and other parts Thursday. It was intentional. Tuesday is the day you come into the office and save yourself the commute elsewise. And that really worked. Even if you've got a completely remote team, I think you need to come together, I will say, at least twice a year. If you can do that from a budget perspective more frequently, amazing. But I think it's really important. And that's, I mean, why do sellers have sales kickoff? Because coming together matters. Rallying the troops matters. Having a common purpose goal and setting that forward and everybody hearing it and rallying together, it matters. And I think the same must be true from a marketing perspective.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's so much more you can get done face-to-face, right? Whiteboarding and just getting people's opinions and building those relationships, which is another important part. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this starts to play out. So let's shift a little bit to the B2B sales arena. Sellers are, you know, constantly under fire these days. Quota attainment continues to decline. One of the things you said earlier was that you had a great relationship with your sales leader back at PwC. And I think certainly that sales marketing relationship is so critical. But why do you think quota attainment is going down?
Oh,
wow. And is it bad? Is it, you know, too high? You know, some people say, well, the quotas are unrealistic and the revenue growth is, overwhelming, but
I think that the saying goes, you can't cut your way to growth, right? I think expectations and, I think on one hand, there is an appreciation and a realization that there is a consolidation in the marketplace and that sales cycles are longer and all of these things. But then in the next breath, it's, well, then how come this, you know, didn't come to fruition? So I think the growing pains are happening faster, right? The cycle that we may have been used to over the course of our careers is happening in a really compressed period of time. And so I think it's the realization of the market and how those quotas were set at the, you know, when they were. We're just not used to things shifting as rapidly as they are. That's I think the nuts and bolts. I think the other thing that I think we can all appreciate is, you know, we had this pullback during the pandemic, and then we had this hiring rush, and the great resignation. And then everybody was hired. You've had immense turnovers on teams, on sales teams, on marketing teams, on, you know, so those relationships and the institutional knowledge isn't what it maybe once was, because there was a lot of shift in the teams. And then so to rebuild the teaming, to rebuild the knowledge base, to, you know, all of those types of things at that scale, I think is also an impact. But those are just, you know, my thoughts.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I think you know, there's a bunch of different things we're seeing, but certainly it's harder to sell today, I think, than ever before. You've got the macroeconomic conditions, right? It was easy when, you know, the dollars were flowing and people were spending money like drunken sailors, right? So even the mediocre sellers do well. You know, look at the real estate market, right? And people rushing out to the suburbs. I mean, people were making fortunes that were below average realtors, right? So I think now the stakes are definitely higher. Right. I mean, you know, we're in the market now and we're going around a little bit and I'm like, this is not hard, you know? And then every house is just inundated with offers and you know, it's like, I don't know. But anyway, so like that's kind of what's going on now, you know, in B2B. So the buyers are saying they want, they don't even want to deal with sellers. They don't have to. They love to just do 100% online and, you know, click a button. So I think, you know, there's a lot going on. I think sellers have to figure out how to add more value, have to do more, you know, discovery.
Let's unpack that one for a second, though, because I think. Okay. So we all know, I think the Gartner stat said 67% of the way through their buying process, right? Before they engage with a seller, even more now. So we know that customers want this sort of digital buying experience, except from an executive perspective, because they're looking at the revenue, they're investing more in sales than they are in marketing. And so you, the sellers actually have to work harder to try and get their foot in the door because there's less brand awareness and demand creation because that marketing dollars has been shifted over to revenue producing headcount because it's easier to measure on a balance sheet. And so you're shifting some of those sparse resources into a manual part of the business, which is performing, which is more difficult to perform at because you're taking away the resources that creates the air cover and the awareness in the market too. So some of this is also resource shift. And yeah, I mean, there, I think there's some of that as well there. I mean, there's, it's multi-factor that, and you know, too, as we already said, like the, on the buying side, it's going through more hurdles. The buying committee on the client side is significantly greater. They're waiting to see whether or not do you really need it? What's the opportunity cost of doing nothing? In some cases, maybe they're not looking at the opportunity cost of necessarily doing nothing, but they're just thinking, you know what, do I really need to spend this money right now? Or the CFO is just like, we're going to wait.
No, you're right. And like sales is getting harder, but I think buying is getting harder too. And it just becomes, like you said, is it worth it? You know, like, first of all, do I want to stick my neck out? Second of all, do I want to have to manage the buying committee of 10 to 12 people where we can't get consensus? And it's just like, you know, let's just leave it the way it is, you know? So sellers, the biggest thing today is like, find a pain that's worth solving, you know? And if you can't find that, it's just going to be a long cycle with back and forth and then a no decision and a buyer going dark on you. So it's like, find that pain, quantify that pain, show them that the risk of the status quo is really, really risky. Then you get some movement, you know, but, and not all sellers are trained that way, or find that, you know, instinctively the way to do it. Right. So everyone's like, I'm comfortable doing a demo. I'm comfortable talking about our organization, the solution, how it works, the founders. You know, now it's more of a, you know, let's really improve our discovery. Let's quantify the impact of, you know, the status quo, and then really quantify those benefits. Because at the end of the day, then you get to the CFO, and if you haven't done a business case, you're going to be stalled out because they're going to say, well, why should we invest this money? What's the return? So anyway, a lot going on there. But your point on marketing is really good. I hadn't even really thought of that. But it does make it way more difficult. So cool.
Also, when you think about it, and it'll be interesting to see what happens over the long term, especially as AI becomes more prevalent to the operationalization of the revenue flow. But I think in the sales marketing relationship, you know, as we've seen this evolution into sort of a revenue operation, where in some cases marketing reports to a chief revenue officer, which is generally taken up the sales route, with AI and people wanting to do more self-service and almost an e-commerce more experience or marketplaces, if you think about like the AWS marketplace, et cetera. Does it actually almost flip into sort of e-commerce led or marketing led revenue? This, you know, this is over the longer term, but it'll be interesting to see that kind of come to fruition. I don't know.
Yeah. We'll have to see. Tricky.
It's all very tricky.
So we talked about AI. Yeah, everything's tricky today. If you have the answers, you know, you'll be sitting pretty. As long as you expect change and figure out how to manage it or lead it, you're in the driver's seat. So AI, what's a good example? You know, how have you leveraged it? You know, we talked a little bit about bad AI, which is, you know, spewing more of the stuff that doesn't work, cluttering inboxes and less personalization and laziness potentially. What's your take on it, and how is it? What are some good examples of how it's helping today?
Yeah, gosh. Well, I can say personally, I'm only just starting to dip my toes in the water, and it's fascinating. It really is, both what works and what doesn't work. and then, you know, some of the things that I've been learning is, you know, even if you're looking at, say, the same prompt that you created 6 months ago, your output is going to be different now than it was then because the model has changed or the backend data has changed. And so you have to be pretty rigorous about almost note keeping of what you're actually kind of how it's applying in the cause and effect. But the way that I'm starting to think about it sort of operationally is potentially as a galvanizing force to bring a team together. You know, we talked about the importance of bringing a team together for an in-person type of experience, and what more important thing than to learn together or to set forward a charter together as a team and ideate. And so that's kind of where, you know, as a leader, I'm starting to think, of course, on the edges, and there's some pretty low-hanging fruit in terms of optimization, graphics creation, headline testing, and, you know, those types of things. But how do you make it pervasive through perhaps a large team and use that as an opportunity to create a different level of camaraderie and spark some new ideas? And so those are some of the things that I'm getting excited about, just in terms of, you know, how might we think through a different way of working?
Yeah, no, I think that's great. Certainly to be determined. We've had a few folks on. We had Dr. Lisa Palmer on. I don't know if I introduced you guys yet, but she's all about AI. And she contends that the biggest danger, what she said today, is the biggest danger companies are facing today in regards to AI is sitting and waiting and not getting involved today. And she also was talking about some examples, trying to remember the companies, but some companies that were kind of lagging behind the competition now using AI to jump back up top. And it reminded me a little bit of the Best Buy example. They were kind of floundering before the pandemic, but then suddenly they were the leaders in curbside delivery. They figured out how to do this. I was watching their CEO on a Goldman Sachs interview, and she was talking about, and that led a major revival for their business. So it's really a very powerful weapon if you could figure out, you know, how best to use it. So,
yeah, I think what
and
what
then
I,
on the flip side, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Michelle. No, you go.
I was reading a headline that a lot of companies are starting to think about AI in their product, but very few are thinking about how to apply it sort of within the operations of their business, especially sales and marketing. It's interesting. I'm kind of just underscoring your original point here.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And then I've had also other folks on who've said, tried it too early and not for me. So, you know, super interesting. So a couple of, you know, final points and questions I have for you. We talked about this a little bit, but I read this interesting article about the CEO-CMO relationship in a McKinsey report. Curious what your take is on that. Obviously, it's super important. But one of the things that was, troubling was that the CMO really doesn't have a full chair at the table in the C-suite in some organizations, which is leading to more of the CMO as the executor of the strategy versus the creator and executor of the strategy. Wondering what your thoughts are there, and based on your experience in the past, how has that impacted your success?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as a generalization, as a rule, I think that's probably pretty true. I think that for a couple of reasons. Mm. I think that marketers really need to contextualize what they're doing in the context of the business language, right? So it's mm-hmm. not about MQLs and all of these types of things. It's what are we contributing to the business, and actually talking in the rest of the language that the rest of the C-suite. So start with vocabulary. And secondly, I think, and Mark Seuss and I have had a number of conversations about this. It is generally misunderstood that the impact of marketing and the impact of sales, for instance, are happening at the same point in time. So your sales, that marketing is about engaging with future customers. And so you can bring down that expense from a cost perspective today, pocket those savings from a P&L perspective, and think, oh, everything's fine, we didn't break anything. Until the length of the full set length of the marketing and sales cycle, and then all of a sudden, what happened to the revenue? And so that time lag, the understanding of that time lag, that what marketing delivers in Q2 and what sales delivers in Q2 have nothing to do with each other. Maybe it's what, just let's call it a 12-month sales cycle. Maybe it's 12, Q2 a year prior, marketing was able to impact the sales of, what's happening in Q2 of this year. Of course, then you've got all of the macroeconomic headwinds and the change in the market and, whether or not the client is still in the market to buy or ready to buy. But I think fundamentally they're, and I don't know, I think people just get busy and people forget. If you have a common sense conversation, I think people understand that. But you have to make it explicit and remind sort of the time lag between the cause and the effect. And that's mm-hmm. something that becomes challenging. People are impatient. They're on, if you're a public company, you've got quarterly results to deliver. And so they're looking around the table and having a now conversation. And the marketer mm-hmm. is, there are things, of course, in marketing, I've led my teams, we're digging in to help bring as much of that revenue across the line as possible with tactical, collaborative, now actions. But the bulk of marketing is forward-looking. And I think that that's a major disconnect and one that is often forgotten and only muddied further by the fact that you're talking about the number of impressions or, MQLs or these things that are not part of the core business at the table. And so it's just, oh, there's marketing again, and they're talking about their latest creative versus the impact of the business and fighting for investment today when you're in a cost-constrained environment that isn't going to yield for some period of time. But, I don't know. I think that has to do a lot with it.
Yeah. No, I agree. And then last question, kind of accountability, marketing accountability. How should marketing be held accountable to what business outcomes? Or how have you seen it? And what do you recommend?
Oh gosh, at the end of the day, it has to be profitable growth, and keyword on profitable. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think has fallen out of business parlance because investment was so inexpensive for so long, a decade, right? Really cheap money. And it's not even particularly expensive, but at the moment, it's just, you have to be more prudent, and it has to be profitable growth. You cannot just grow for growth's sake. And so marketing must be accountable to helping grow the business in a meaningful and profitable way. And I don't know that you're ever going to get down to 100%, you know, there's too many, because of when you make the, like the campaign action or the marketing action, and when it's really actually realized, and then all of the market forces, I don't think you're ever going to get to 100% accuracy. You're just, from an ROI perspective, there's too much time and there's too many multiple factors, but you can get a lot better at predicting that by looking at a different set of data.
Love it. Well, Michelle, this was great as always. Wonderful conversation. Really appreciate you coming on. How do folks get in touch with you? What's the best way if they want to reach out? Email or LinkedIn, or what's your preference?
It's the easiest one. Everybody knows where to go. So I'll send you to LinkedIn and we'll figure it out from there.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Michelle. Hope you come back. And so much excitement going on today in the space. And congratulations on your success, and wishing you continued good fortune. And we'll have you back at some point to talk about what you're doing in your next iteration. So thanks so much for coming. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And we will be talking to you soon. And have a good day.
Thanks, Dan.
Peace.